This is Here's How, Ireland's political, social and current affairs podcast, presented by William Campbell.
Thank you for downloading episode 61 of Here's How. The Brexit negotiations have started. That's a big challenge for the British government and the Irish government too. In this episode, I'm talking to one former government advisor about how competent both of them are to do their jobs.
Here's How is Ireland's political, social and current affairs podcast. Make your view heard. Just dial 076 603 5060 and tell the world what you're thinking. Your voicemail may be included in the next podcast. You can find tips on recording your contribution and other ways to contact the show at hereshow.ie/call.
In the last podcast, I was talking to Jim Geraghty of the PSEU. That's the union that represents higher level public sector workers. The interview was in the aftermath of the PSEU conference, where Tom was demanding a reversal of the pay cuts of 2009. There was quite a lot of comment online about that interview. Much of it was not very sympathetic to Tom. I said that I'd come back to that topic and I want to say a few things, but hang on, because there are actually some things that I want to say that are more supportive of Tom than you might expect. But I can't say that I agreed with him on everything. You might not be too surprised at that if you remember the interview. Some of the things that Tom said that I couldn't agree with, and judging by the reaction online, I'm not alone. One of those things that I disagreed with Tom was when he said that the public sector was proactive in using new technology. I really don't know how he gets this. I wrote a book about governance in Ireland 8 years ago, and one of the many examples of the terrible deployment of technology in the government sector that I used was the Residential Tenancies Board, the RTB. Their job is to keep and publish a register of landlords and rented homes. It's not that difficult. At that time, in 2009, I criticised the fact that the RTB weren't even able to put a simple database online with a basic search function. They published the register in raw Microsoft Excel files, and they used dozens of them because they were on Microsoft Excel 97, which has a file limit of 65,000 lines, so anyone who wanted to use the full register had to download dozens of these Microsoft Excel files. It is trivially easy to create an SQL database from the information, and I could make a searchable front end for the data that would work on any computer or mobile phone in an afternoon. But I've just had a look at the RTB website again. 9 years later, the RTB is still using a 20-year-old version of Microsoft Excel to create massive files that have to be downloaded to be read. It's awkward and difficult at best. If you're trying to use it on your phone, like, say, a student or other tenant who has limited space and budget, it's hopelessly useless. Now, hang on, I do have something positive to say about Tom Geraghty's demands. But before that, Tom challenged me when I mentioned cases of people working in the public service suspended on pay for years. Richard Boyd Barrett, TD, got a response from the Minister of Justice, Francis Fitzgerald, last month, saying one Garda sergeant had been suspended from duty on pay since March 2010 and another Garda has been suspended since June 2010. And a prison officer has been paid a third of €1 million since July 2010 despite not having worked a day. He's been suspended all that time. The Tánaiste also confirmed that a further three Gardaí have been suspended since 2012, with three more Gardaí since 2013, another two Gardaí suspended since 2014, and six suspended since 2015. All of them are being paid out of taxpayers' money, and none of them are doing a tap of work. Anyone working in the private sector could not be anything other than gobsmacked by this abuse. But I can tell you from personal experience that this type of thing is not rare in the public sector. I don't have to tell anyone outside the public sector what the chances of getting a 7-year paid holiday are if you're in the competitive sector. You either work or you get put out on your ear. Now, hang on, I do have something positive to say about the demands that Tom Geraghty is making. But before that, he also disputed the point that I made that there's a toxic and destructive culture in many areas of the public sector. Last February, a report to the National Museum of Ireland said that 40% of its employees complained that they were regularly subjected to bullying. The psychologist who wrote the report said that 40% of the staff were at risk of developing anxiety or depression. Hardly surprising, this bullying has been going on for decades. She said, and this is a quote, she said, "I'm over 25 years doing this work. I never heard the story being so consistent and coming from individuals not in the same room. The toxic nature of what was presented, that's what's so awful, relentless and systematic." In case you don't know, the National Museum of Ireland is the building right beside the Dáil on Kildare Street. It's literally next door. Situations like this are inevitably the fault of local management, making one of two failings. 40% of staff being bullied for decades is not the type of thing that can be kept secret in an organisation. Either local management are refusing to take action against the bullies, or they are the bullies. And again, this is an extreme case, but I can tell you from personal experience that bullying, very severe adult bullying, is widespread in the public sector. But I do have something positive to say about Tom Geraghty's demands for the public sector. And it's this. Consider the opposite. Look at the casualization of labour. Look at any employer in the gig economy. Look at Uber. Buy a car, make yourself an independent contractor, which sounds fine, until you get sick and there's no sick pay, or get old and there's no pension, or get busy and lose your 5-star rating, or get slack and there's no work and therefore no pay. Or look at Deliveroo. They had a strike of their food delivering cycle couriers in London recently because they were being reclassified as independent contractors, them and their bike. The company even wrote to their office staff telling them to use vocabulary such as onboarding at a supply centre, not training at headquarters, and to ask their riders about availability rather than shifts. Riders don't wear uniforms, it's kit or equipment. All of this to maintain the fiction that this is not a situation of employment. Or look at Dell. For years, it provided employment in Limerick. Then the labour cost skills matrix shifted, and Poland became more attractive. Hello, Reznov. Goodbye, Rahin. Large employers have huge power. No one worker can hope to negotiate a fair deal from them. Tom Geraghty is right that workers need to pressure governments to make sure employers treat them fairly. But that's the point. Treat them fairly. We need decent employment standards. Casual jobs might be fine for teenagers or students, but what happens 10 years later when you want to start a family? Or when you're trying to send those kids to college? We need decent employment standards, but we have to be realistic. Employees in the competitive sector don't push for public sector standards because they know that even if they won them, they'd still lose, because any business that operated like the public sector would be out of business and their employees would be out of a job in short order. So that's the positive thing about what Tom Geraghty has to say. He's right that employees need protection. But there's also a negative thing I have to say about Tom Geraghty. When competitive sector employees hear him talking, hear his nonsense about the public sector being at the forefront of technological development, but they can't even check the register of rented properties on their phone, hear him talking about the productivity of staff who start work an hour and a half later after they do, or spend years suspended on full pay for offences that would have them sacked if not prosecuted. When they hear him, they don't hear anything they can relate to. When competitive sector employees hear Tom Geraghty, they're hearing the enemy. And when workers are divided, the bosses are laughing.
Do you agree? Do you disagree? If you want your point of view heard, dial 076 603 5060 and leave a contribution for the show. The lines are open 24/7 and you can find tips on how to record a good contribution and other ways to contact the podcast at hereshow.ie/call.
Before I go on, I just want to remind you that you can get the podcast and subscribe to it with any software that you can subscribe to podcasts with. That's iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn Radio and lots of other software and mobile phone apps. But if you don't use any of those, you can still subscribe to the podcast and get a reminder every time there's a new one up online. Just go to the website and there's a little form on the side where you can enter your email address. I promise you won't get any spam, but what you will get is one little email every time a new podcast is put up, and it'll have a link that you can click and listen on the website. So why not go ahead and subscribe to that now while you're listening. On the line now, I have Derek Mooney. He is a speechwriter, a public affairs and communications advisor, and he's a former Irish government advisor as well. And he writes for Broadsheet.ie and Slugger O'Toole. Derek, you work out of Brussels as well as Dublin, I know, so I'm sure the full might of the British civil service that once ran an empire will have no trouble at all with these piffling little Brexit negotiations.
Well, that's certainly the line that's coming out of certain parts of Westminster, but I think the truth of it is far away from that. In terms of conducting negotiation, you talk to anyone who has been involved in negotiations, either through industrial relations or people who've been involved in peace building and conflict resolution, mm-hmm. there are certain fundamentals to negotiations. Now, in this case, the British have decided, absolutely democratically, through a legitimate referendum, that they're leaving the European Union. The nature of how they're leaving has never been really determined in terms of you leave the European Union, but you can possibly stay inside the customs union, possibly stay inside the single market. You have the whole range of relationships. There's a very nice graphic that's been produced online, which shows a whole range of kind of Venn diagrams of various relationships countries across Europe have with the European Union.
There's the Switzerland option and the Norway option and so forth.
Exactly. In addition to the original 28 and now what will soon be 27, who are members of the European Union, so therefore have the whole suite of measures. But that decision has been made. So now what we're looking at is the negotiation of the outcome. So that this isn't a battle anymore about the outcome. This is now a negotiation about the terms of it. There are two particular dynamics to any negotiation. Number one is what they call a kind of attitudinal structuring, which is you try and get the other side to see your point of view. And similarly, you try and start seeing like what is deliverable for them. So you try and put the other person into your shoes and try and put yourself into the other person's shoes and seeing what the deliverables are.
Mm-hmm.
And the British seem to be doing the exact opposite. Rather than trying to not so much curry favour or curry sympathy across Europe, what they seem to be doing is saying, basically throwing insults, hurling insults and saying, look, we don't have to do this negotiation. Not having a deal is okay by us. Now, that's great in terms of political bravado, but it doesn't really carry much when you're going to have to deal with these people afterwards.
But isn't that happening on both sides, Derek? That, for example, the British government announced, I think pretty much unilaterally, that all the negotiations should be done in English. Yeah. And the EU Juncker has been saying recently, talking obviously very pointedly about how the English language is going to decline in importance in Europe. Isn't this kind of unhelpful attitude coming from both sides?
Yeah, I wouldn't be one to claim that all the ill is on one side, and I'm not saying that there haven't been a certain amount of messing around from people in Brussels and elsewhere. But at the end of the day, a lot of this has come, I mean, in terms of for every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. And for the moment the Brits ramp up the rhetoric, well, then somebody on the European side is going to respond to that. I think what a lot of people have been pointing to recently is the leaks that emerged from the dinner in number 10. Now, the fact that those leaks emerged in the first place wasn't helpful. And I think there seems to be a belief in Europe that basically what happened was that Juncker had prepared a note or had actually given a kind of a briefing to Chancellor Merkel on what had happened, which was, if the note is correct, it's quite extraordinary. But it wasn't helpful that note emerged. It didn't help for this to emerge in the papers and for this to emerge in the first week or first 10 days of the British general election, because then the British could make the accusation against Juncker et al. Well, whoever allowed this leak or whoever authorised this leak was doing so to interfere with the British general election. So, I mean, that certainly hasn't helped the background noise. But you can long predate that with stuff coming out from Europe and stuff coming from Boris Johnson, from Liam Fox and from Theresa May herself. Go back to her first speech on Chatham House, which was quite positive and quite productive, and basically saying, look, we will always want to have a good relationship with Europe, and it's not in our interest for Europe to fail or for the European Union to fail. And that's what the election was. And it has given the impression, look, we can crash out of the EU without a deal and we won't have to pay a price for that. Well, the sorry fact is, yes, you will. And you will lose a lot. And already you see, while the British economy is not kind of feeling the pain of Brexit, yes, because of the fall in sterling, we're certainly feeling it here. I mean, agriculture prices have dropped here like a stone.
Can I talk to you about one or two things within that? One is whether the British leadership, that's to say cabinet members and maybe the advisers that they surround themselves with rather than the actual civil servants, do you think it's possible that they're being hopelessly naive? Because one thing that I mentioned, I talked to Peter Lilly, who's an arch Brexiteer and a very famous MP from the 1990s and John Major's government in particular. And I challenged him with some tweets from Michael Gove that were sent in the immediate aftermath of the referendum, where Michael Gove was saying, we're not going to talk to Brussels at all. We're going to go straight to Berlin and negotiate individual trade deals with individual EU members, not realizing that that was entirely illegal. Michael Gove also suggested that they would not use Article 50 to leave the EU, that they would structure some other way of doing that. Again, entirely naive about the legal situation. Is it possible that these are people who are in essentially the situation of a dog chasing a boss? They never really expected to catch it, and they have no idea what to do now.
I think there is a large element of that, and I think although the polls were pointing at that, and I think the polls actually were not as bad as everyone was saying on this one, but although it was pointing that this was going to be very, very close, I don't think anyone seriously believed that this was going to be defeated, that this was going to be passed. Nobody seriously thought the Remain side would be defeated, but that would be feared that this would continue on. So therefore, the result has caught everyone by surprise. You're right, but even to this day, there is still some confusion, because one of the things that has become an issue, and it will be an issue in the first phase of the negotiations, is the status of EU citizens living in Britain and the status of British citizens living across the EU. Now, while there is kind of a right up to this point, so therefore, until the moment the agreement is made, from people up to that point, they're all covered. But once Britain is out of the EU, the EU cannot negotiate on behalf of EU citizens in the UK. The UK will have to negotiate their status with each of the 27 countries. But that doesn't appear to have occurred to anyone within Britain.
Explain what's happening there. So right now, the EU citizens...
Right, up to this point, the EU can negotiate with Britain. Right up to now, there's an arrangement between Britain and the other 27, which is part of the EU.
So the freedom of movement.
EU citizens can live as complete freedom of movement. That's exactly it. What happens thereafter is that Britain will then have to... The EU cannot negotiate the rights of British citizens to live in Bulgaria or to live in Ireland or to live... Because that they'll have to be bilateral arrangements. But the talks about the way this has been spoken about by Boris Johnson and David Davis, it gives the impression, or certainly it looks as if they think that they can negotiate this deal into the future with the EU. The EU has no competence in that area.
So unlike a lot of things, this is something where the EU hasn't taken power, and that could actually...
No, because the EU can only negotiate between fellow members. It can't negotiate with what they call third countries. It's not something on which the whole thing will fall, but it's just an indication of how several very leading British politicians, people who actually are in senior positions on this particular issue, really missed the point. In the same way that Liam Fox thought that he could start negotiating trade deals straight away and gave the impression that there were countries lining up to negotiate these straight off. They're certainly prepared to explore them, but the negotiations on this are not going to happen until the end point. And the other point to bear in mind is Article 50 negotiations are just about leaving the EU. They're not about the situation post that.
Also, I think people, perhaps you might comment on this, I think people are being naive about the tightness of the timing. We have obviously the UK general election next month. In September, there have to be the French parliamentary elections, then there is the general election essentially in Germany.
The
federal elections in September. It's likely that it'll take a month or more for them to make a government because they need to make coalitions in Germany. And with Christmas, that leaves about 2 months of maybe October and November for negotiations to happen at a serious level, government to government, in the first year after the triggering of Article 50. At the other end, at its very most ambitious, you would need 6 months for the 27 governments to ratify a deal. Yeah. That means that after 2 months in 2017, there is at best eight or nine months in 2018, and that's it.
Yeah. Oh, no, that's it, except that the 27 can decide to, by unanimity, can decide to extend that deadline. But in terms of even a negotiation, when you've got the British on the far side of the table, the 27 might necessarily do that. They might feel, well, hang a second, all these negotiations are going to, all the kind of the key elements are going to be negotiated in the 59th minute of the 23rd hour. Mm-hmm. So we're going to push this right to the very, very edge. So, I mean, it is an extremely complicated situation. There are three issues to be resolved first. Number one is how much does Britain owe the EU by virtue of exiting? How much is it committed to various true EU budgets, in terms of EU institutions located here, there, and hither and yon, in terms of UK staff working within the Commission, etc. So how much will the exit bill cost? You then have the status of EU citizens, the second issue, mm-hmm. and the Irish borders, the third issue. Now, those three don't have to be resolved, but there has to be sufficient progress made on them before they then get on to the issues of post Article 50 trade, et cetera. When Barnier was here last in Dublin, he spoke in Dublin in the Oireachtas last Thursday. One of the he said, look, these negotiations can be done on time. We can complete them if there is an absence of naivety and aggression. And I think the problem is, the point of my broadsheet piece is he didn't just say that out of kind of just, this is the normal courtesies of negotiations. I think he's very specific. I think he put those words in for a very, very clear reason, which is that's exactly what they're getting. What they're seeing from the British is naivety and aggression at the same, one at the same time. And therefore saying, look, these negotiations were always going to be complex. But if this is the stance that the British government is going to take from here on in, then this is going to become damn near impossible. And I just wonder, is Barnier, he's not preparing the ground for failure, but I think there's a small, very gentle warning shot across the British bow saying, look, this naivety and aggression is not going to resolve this. You're not going to get what you want. And by the way, you're sitting across the table from 27 other countries.
There's two things that I want to finish on. The first one is The Guardian recently had a piece about a particular car component, just one component, that crossed the channel five times during its manufacture. There's been, and that's sort of a reply to the UKIP type rhetoric that says, the German car workers will be our best allies in negotiations because they'll tell Merkel they want to keep selling us German cars. Is it possible that that naivety, imagining that there will be no difficulty at five custom crosses for a single car component, is it possible that that naivety is reaching up towards the level of the cabinet?
Unfortunately, I think it is. It's not Liam Fox, it's the other guy, the industry secretary, who has given a letter of comfort to Nissan, basically saying, look, if we crash out of the EU and you're subjected to WTO tariffs, that we're going to firewall you, we're going to kind of compensate you against those for selling into Europe. So, I mean, there's a huge range of naivety on this one. Yesterday, we had an interesting little development, which I think will play out in the shorter, longer term, not in Britain's interests, is that Macron has appointed Edouard Philippe as his prime minister.
He's the mayor of Le Havre, isn't he?
That's the whole point, and that's the key to it. Everyone's kind of pointed to the fact that he's appointed a guy from the centre-right party, Les Republicans, which is probably a very, very astute.
This is where a lot of Irish people, including myself, would have sailed to on their holidays to France.
Precisely. But Le Havre is that. It's an entry point. And in Britain, what you have, don't forget, you have what's called in France, a thing called the Le Touquet Agreement, which is that British customs are now exercised on the French side of the border.
Yeah, this is a little bit like the Irish people going through American immigration at Shannon.
Yeah. Now, that's a very positive thing, and you can see huge benefits on both sides. But now that you have these problems with Calais, are people trying to get into the UK, they're now being kept at Calais. So what this guy, the mayor of Le Havre, now Macron had already said that the Le Touquet agreement was going to have to be revisited. This guy, Edouard Philippe, has a long track record of absolutely opposing it. This is back on the agenda, at which point that means that all those, and anyone who's been in the north of France, and I have friends who just live up the road from Calais, they're just outside Dunkirk, and you see you see small little kind of satellite refugee camps off the side of roads and motorways, etc. So this is a huge issue. It's a huge problem. I mean, it has been a massive burden for Calais to bear for the last couple of years. All that is now going to move to the British side. So Theresa May needs to go back to the language of the Chatham House speech. And as soon as this election over, they've got to start dialing down the rhetoric considerably. But the problem is, I think it's a management of expectations. It's that top point you say about UKIP, etc., that they really have bugged it up. Because the other point I was going to say about Calais and Le Havre, etc., is I think it takes because of the customs union, and because of the free movement of goods and people and services, trucks going from the continent to the UK go through in about 30, 40 seconds. They reckon it'll take 30 minutes when the border is returned for every truck. So there's something like 20 or 30,000 trucks per day going through any one of these ports. I mean, just the actual, the process of this, the burden that it's going to create. And by the way, it's going to be here because we are going to have a border. That was the one point I think a lot of people didn't fully pick up on what Barnier said, which is if Britain is out of the customs union, then the border that runs across our island will be an international border once again.
When the EU27 met for, I think, about 4 minutes, they agreed that their negotiating priorities with the UK were three things. That was, as I remember it, people, money and Ireland. Was that a negotiating triumph for Enda Kenny?
No, I wouldn't say that. And I'll tell you why. Because first and foremost, and this is a particular tribute to Barnier himself, Barnier was the commissioner during the peace process, etc. And he's the guy, one of the people, mainly in those venues, it was mainly Jacques Delors, in terms of the peace funding for Northern Ireland and the interest, which was a huge contributor, which is a huge factor. One of the things that's highly underestimated is the importance of that peace one, peace two. So, I mean, so therefore, Europe is intimately involved in this. So I'm not trying to underplay, I'm not trying to understate, because I think Enda Kenny has had a huge influence here. But for example, the concession, inverted commas, that in the event of reunification, that Northern Ireland would automatically become part of the EU, is nothing more than a restatement of what happened in terms of German reunification. What I'm hearing, certainly from my contacts in Brussels, etc., is that in terms of negotiation, there are various things that the European Union is looking at to minimise the impact on Irish agriculture of Britain crashing out of the European Union. So there is a lot of constructive stuff happening there where the Irish government is having a positive impact. So there are issues still there.
Derek Mooney, former government advisor and speechwriter and public affairs and communications advisor, thank you very much for talking to me.
You're more than welcome. Cheers.
Never miss a show. Follow at Here's How Podcast on Twitter and like Here's How on Facebook for updates on each show's contents.
That's almost the end of episode 60 of Here's How, Ireland's political, social and current affairs podcast, published on the 19th of May 2017. I have references in the show notes on the website for most of the things I was talking about, and if you can think of a topic that should be covered on a future show, or if you want to suggest someone to include, and that could be yourself, then let me know. If you like the podcast, please go on iTunes and give it a rating or even write a nice review. Also, please like the show on Facebook, follow the podcast on Twitter at Here's How Podcast, and follow Derek Mooney at DS Mooney, and subscribe to the podcast so new shows automatically come up in your podcast feed. You can use iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, or any other podcast app or software. And as I said, you can subscribe by email now as well. There's a little form on the website. There's full information about all of that and contact details for the show too. It's all at www.hereshow.ie. The next show will be uploaded shortly. The Here's How podcast is produced and presented by me, William Campbell. Thank you for listening.